Today on Against the Grain, how we remember the past appears innate. A look back to the lost innocence of childhood and adolescence, to the sounds and sensations of our early years. But historian Gary Cross says that how we remember the past, and what past we even choose to remember, has everything to do with contemporary capitalism, based on the rapid consumption of products. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. How is memory constructed? It seems a given that we would look back, perhaps longingly, to our youth, but that's a historically new phenomenon. And our valorization of youth has to do with the rise of capitalism, with its glorification of the new. As historian Gary Cross argues, memory today, at least since the 1970s, has come to be defined by fleeting consumer items, while our sense of time passing has become faster and faster. It's through the toys and TV shows or pop songs of our childhoods that we anchor our memories, which is ironic since these products were made to be short-lived and quickly discarded. Gary Cross is Distinguished Professor of Modern History at Pennsylvania State University and the author, among other books, of Consume Nostalgia, Memory in the Age of Fast Capitalism, which is published by Columbia University Press. Gary, it's often said that our feelings about the past are, in fact, as much about the present. How would you describe our present and its impact on how we see the past?
People certainly use the past to help them make sense of their present, as well as to escape from the present. And in many cases, what has happened is that change comes so quickly to us that that people try to find way of rooting themselves, particularly in memories of their childhood. And as time moves more quickly, and their ears, well, for example, like the 1970s, and even in our own time, when things seem to change so quickly, that nostalgia becomes a kind of a ready answer to coping with all those changes.
Well, I want to ask you about nostalgia in our time, but I wonder if you can help us understanding in context by talking about other forms of nostalgia historically.
Right. Well, my theme, of course, is that there's something very new about contemporary nostalgia, at least parts of it. But you have to really go back about 250 years when you come to a time when people weren't nostalgic at all. Because nostalgia really depends upon there being rapid change, and also a good deal of movement. People up until, say, the middle of the 18th century and even later, very seldom moved at all, and things didn't change very much, except the seasons and periodic catastrophes like war or death or what have you. So it is really only in modern times that people begin to become nostalgic. Often they're nostalgic for an older regime that has maybe passed by. You see that among old French aristocrats who long for the old regime after the French Revolution, or people who experienced industrialization, kind of longing for simple village life or what they perceived to be that. Of course, you see nostalgia today among East Europeans who look back fondly upon the days of the Soviet Union or of East Germany. So these are kind of common patterns of nostalgia that have come down to us from the past.
So would it be fair to say then that a fundamental shift took place probably in the 1700s with the rise of capitalism, when people's lives became much more dislocated and hence looking back longingly became much more part of our lives?
Right. Of course, a lot of this has to do with the very rapid change that capitalism and the technology that went with it brought to us. The coming of things like railroads in the 19th century, the huge shift from production of goods through craft methods to factory production under capitalism. All of that, of course, is part of this this change that makes people nostalgic, often for the goods of the past or sometimes for the ways of life of the past. So you find, for example, in the late 19th century, people trying to recover old peasant ways by sort of restoring old village life. You see this like Skansen up in Stockholm, which is one of the earliest. But you also see it in the 20th century, even in the form of somebody like Henry Ford's Greenfield Village. I mean, Henry Ford brought more change than almost anyone else in the early 20th century, but he even longed for the recovery of a lost time of artisan production and village life.
And you write that a lot of nostalgia has historically been tied up with displacement of people not being in the place that their ancestors were in over long, long stretches of time, and that nostalgia has historically had to do with dislocation from place.
Right. Nostalgia really means longing for one's home or one's former abode. And, of course, the earliest nostalgiacs, if you want to call them that, are people like mercenary soldiers. The term was actually invented by a doctor who was treating mercenaries from Switzerland who were homesick for alpine meadows and Swiss soups and that sort of thing. And so as people have moved, particularly Americans, who were probably the most mobile people in human history, even Americans are famous for being homesick. Even those tough ones like my ancestors who moved west without really much thought of the families they left behind. Eventually, yeah, they become homesick even for that.
What about capitalism's sort of intense focus on the new and novelty, which characterizes modernity? How has that shaped people's notions of the past if the society is so focused much of the time on the new?
Right. Well, the focus on the new brings as its inevitable complement nostalgia for the old. And this is, you know, simply as if you live in a world where nothing changes very much and people venerate the past in the present, there's actually not much nostalgia because there's not much distance from between the present and the past. But when people begin to sense a gap because of novelty, a gap from the present to the past, then they begin to become nostalgic for things that were once new and now are gone.
Capitalism has also been associated with the idea of progress, of, you know, the march forward to the newer and the better. And yet that notion has become much more shaky. How has that influenced our notions of nostalgia, our notions right. of the past now?
Well, one of the really interesting things about this topic is that since World War II, people have become much more interested in heritage. And part of this, in all sorts of forms, museums, heritage sites, people trying to get back in touch with their family history through all of these more recently these specialty companies that will, you know, let you find out where you really come from based on your DNA and all that. And a lot of this, I think, is a reflection of a kind of a declining faith in the idea of progress, is kind of looking forward to this, the new and the better, you know, Tomorrowland and all of the optimism that came out of all those world's fairs from the 19th century. And so as the future and the certainty about the positive, a positive future, as that wanes, people become more interested in and kind of focused emotionally upon their past, often their imagined past.
How would you define heritage? Is it connected to a particular group of people?
Well, yeah, generally, heritage is really closely associated with nostalgia, although people who are engaged in heritage tourism and heritage sites insist on a difference, and there is some difference, but often the concept of heritage is attached to a particular identification with an ethnicity or perhaps a religion, or with a political movement, or even for that matter to a gender. So heritage may be a way in which people form communities and identify with past communities, but almost always it means excluding people who aren't part of your heritage.
We'll talk more about the focus of your recent work, which is consume nostalgia. You write in your book about earlier forms of nostalgia, and one is communal. And I wonder if what you're describing just now would fit in with communal nostalgia, an idea of a linked past to do with either an ethnic or national group or a political orientation?
Sure. That's a whole lot of it. And that, too, is part of the modern world, as people begin to identify with a particular nationality or political movement or what have you. And it's not that people didn't have tribal identities in the distant past, but in the modern world, people use heritage, they use monuments, they use certain events around which and often holidays or particular dates to commemorate events to form communities. Sometimes communities that are very much fragmented, or for that matter, hardly in existence at all. So you see this among people, ethnic groups who have kind of lost their identity. They begin to focus upon heritage and nostalgia as a way of creating it or restoring it.
And you made the mention a few minutes ago that much of the time the past that's being reclaimed is often a constructed past or an imaginary past.
Sure.
I wonder how you understand political nostalgia today as it operates. One thinks of Donald Trump's slogan, "Make America Great Again." The turn to the past is often about creating an idealized past, often a past that never was, which makes one think of the politics of people like Donald Trump's "Make America Great Again," harkening back to a white America, and that until now America is a place in decline. That kind of politics clearly has a lot of political power. What are your thoughts on the political uses of nostalgia, which touch on that earlier kind of nostalgia you were talking about, the communal form of nostalgia?
Right. Well, this is not particularly new to Trump. I mean, we have a very similar set of ideas around, George Wallace back in the 80s, or, any number of the Ku Klux Klan and other movements as well, Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s and so forth. But what for example, the Trump phenomena represents is, in a lot of ways, part of a concern among people who feel that they have lost control over the dominant values in the culture, over popular culture, over the media, over political elections. They feel that they have lost something, and that that they can restore it to a set of images and political actions, often highly symbolic actions, like putting up a fence across the Rio Grande. But it has a highly symbolic kind of meaning for people. This is because it's what was used in the past, and it seems tangible, I suppose. The same kind of nostalgia appears in trying to preserve, say, Confederate monuments. And this is the language that's used. This is about our heritage. This is about our history, these monuments, which my guess is for many people have been standing for decades and hardly ever noticed. But they become important as a way of sort of rallying around this idea of a lost community, a community that's in decline, and the way to create it or restore it is to rally around these symbols of an earlier age of dominance, in this case of white men for the most part.
Right. This notion of making America great, obviously, centrally to do with race. But I also wonder about, you are writing about the United States, but also imperial countries with an imperial history have a complicated relationship with nostalgia, because often there's, again, a kind of a hearkening back to a lost past of greatness that has now slipped away.
Right. Well, you see this occasionally with countries like England or some of the other European countries that had their own empires. This is actually kind of surprisingly little. There's some out of Russia, of course. The restoration of the old Soviet national anthem, new words, but it's the same song. The kinds of things that you see Putin doing in the Ukraine, and going back and taking over the Crimea, is kind of part of this kind of nostalgia for the old Soviet Union, minus communism, but still part of that idea of national greatness.
That's the voice of Gary Cross. He is author of Consume Nostalgia, Memory in the Age of Fast Capitalism, and he teaches history at Pennsylvania State University. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So turning things to the focus of your work, you argue that there is a particular form of nostalgia that dominates our times, which is quite distinct from other forms of nostalgia, even though some of those may also coexist with it. And that is a particular form of nostalgia associated with the goods of consumption. I wonder if you could explain exactly what you mean by consumed nostalgia.
Well, what I'm basically saying is that nostalgia is to some extent built around memories of childhood and the goods that we associate, and sometimes the media that we associate with growing up. And the part of the reason why people are nostalgic for things like old toys, popular music, even TV shows that you saw when you were, say, 7, 8, maybe to 20 years old, part of the reason why people are nostalgic for those things has to do with the fact that that consumption has become and increasingly rapid in its change. In the 19th century, things didn't change very quickly. Songs lasted, popular songs would last for several years in popularity. And today, and for quite a while now, a lot of things, music, toys, cars, all sorts of things that we associate with the consumer culture, they turn over much more quickly. And so we have this tendency to associate our childhoods with very specific kinds of consumer goods that were popular during our specific childhoods.
So how does consumer nostalgia differ from other forms of nostalgia in the past? It seems that one of the aspects may have to do with who it ties together. In this case, who does it tie together?
Well, what it does do is that every cohort, let's call them, say, well, I'll give you an example. I'm of an age where people my age are very nostalgic for 1957 Chevy hardtops. Okay, it's very specific. I mean, there are a few other things, but this is because when we were growing up and the formative age of getting our first car, a 1957 Chevy hardtop was the thing to have, you know. And if you're younger, it might be a Mustang. If you're still younger, it might be a GTO or some other kind of muscle car. And if you're still younger, it would be, you know, some other vehicle that was popular during that particular period. And this all kind of gets to the notion of fast capitalism, which is to say that each sort of narrow cohort has a very distinct kind of consumer experience. And this produces then a commonality of emotion and interest with people within really quite narrow age ranges.
Right, so we couldn't even call these generations. This is much more thin slice of a demographic group.
It often is. Now, it's not to say that people, I mean, I was, I like doo-wop music, for example, you know, because I'm of an age when doo-wop music was popular. I didn't particularly like it when it was popular, but I associate it now with my own childhood. But if my little brother, who is nearly 4 years younger, doesn't like doo-wop music at all. It's because of those very narrow ranges. And this has a lot to do with just how fast modern capitalism has become. Everything changes so quickly. So what was popular for an 8-year-old in 1952 would not be popular for an 8-year-old in 1958.
What's striking, though, when you write about consumer nostalgia is that there is an emphasis on things being authentic and not being symbolic. I wonder if you could talk about the importance of authenticity, because when you're talking about fast capitalism, of these fleeting moments of these consumer goods, which were made to be used and disposed, you know, they certainly weren't made to endure, it's interesting that authenticity becomes so important.
Right. Well, it's in part because you have to get the object right. It's interesting. People are not nostalgic about wooden blocks or dolls' houses or farm wagons or the kinds of things that you might see in an old heritage site, an old tool. A spinning wheel or something, maybe maybe some are, but not many. It has to be exactly correct. It has to represent precisely the time when you were a child. So it's important to in the modern era to have something that is not symbolic, representing a large group of people or a large period of time, but rather something that that captures your own personal memory at a particular point in time.
So in effect, it's the collector's item for the niche market.
Yeah, well, it has become that. This is another aspect of the point that we, since the beginning of the 20th century, not only have time moving much faster because the flow of goods moves much faster, but we also have this huge sort of fixation upon memories and our experiences from early childhood. Early childhood is a whole lot more important to us modern people than I think it was to people in the past, in part because our childhoods are better. We are given a lot more things. That's certainly part of modern capitalism. And also our memories of our early childhood are not nearly as negative as many people's memories in the past.
Could it also be that it's the time before work starts and...
Well, yeah, and work has, of course, been seriously delayed. In the 19th century, a kid could expect, depending on how rich the parents were, but could, even fairly wealthy people could be expecting to do serious manual labor at 10 or 12 years old, and if you were poor, you might start at 4.
Sure, but also it's interesting the focus on youth as this time of innocence to connect up with also seems tied to fast capitalism and capitalism more generally, focus on the future rather than the past. I mean, you write about how we display pictures, if we have them, of our children, but not our parents. And in those displays, the sort of authentic experience of youth matters.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the really interesting things about the early 20th century, and I've written about it in other contexts, that you begin to find this absolute, almost cultural fixation upon the innocent child, and the need to capture that image before the child becomes dulled and merely a teenager or whatever. This was, of course, one of the major roles played by companies like Kodak, who developed the snapshot camera. And the whole idea is you're supposed to go around and snap pictures of your children before they lost that innocence. So everything was focused on the young, and of course the elders, who used to be in the 19th century the center of every family photograph, they are shunted aside. Sometimes they're just not there at all.
That's the voice of historian Gary Cross. We'll return with him in a moment. Thank you. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Gary Cross. He teaches modern history at Pennsylvania State University and is the author of Consumed Nostalgia, Memory in the Age of Fast Capitalism, which is published by Columbia University Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. His many other books include An All-Consuming Century and Men to Boys. So you have written that all nostalgias consist of organizers and participants. Who are the organizers and who are the participants now in contrast with the past?
Well, particularly today, the organizers tend to be merchants. They tend to be people engaged in a commercial enterprise of providing participants, in this case, a very widely dispersed group of people who are seeking to recover essentially their childhood memories through possessing collections of nostalgic items, be they toys or Disney souvenirs or even those Time Life multiple CDs of 1950s love songs.
Well, music is particularly interesting in all of this because, of course, music is known to be very evocative when it comes to memory, that it can sort of take you back to the moment where you heard the music in your youth or whenever it was. How have the merchants of popular music, in effect, helped shape the way that we connect our memories to the past in this context of fast capitalism?
Right. Well, one of the things that's really interesting about modern commercial music is that it comes and goes very quickly. This is actually dates from the late 19th century in the Tin Pan Alley industry in New York City, where songs were written 1.5 minutes or so long, were put on phonographs. And so what happens is that instead of having a folk song that might have multiple verses and that might become part of a wider community, multicultural community, over time, our music has become increasingly very short-lived. It's a hit and it's gone. And what's interesting about it is that produces a very close association years later between those who remember the song and the time in which they heard it. I think of something like I Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog. You know, I think of being in the fourth grade and I think of it being in 1956. Okay. Over time with oldies channels, that's been blurred a bit. But what the fastness of the music does is helps create a kind of a nostalgia for not just a particular song, but an association of that song with a particular time in the past.
Which is kind of ironic because pop music's supposed to be fleeting and about the present, and then off it goes. And you're saying, in fact, it actually really anchors us to particular moments in the past.
Yes, it tends to be. What's sort of interesting about rock music, it appears in the early 50s, but very quickly there are oldies channels playing oldies but goodies. And when they meant the original oldies record appeared about 1957, and it was playing songs from 1955. And so what's happening is that because the music comes and goes so quickly, it has a way of making us nostalgic for very particular times, and as we get older, we remain interested in the music of our childhoods. I have to admit, I have a satellite radio, and I never listened to the 1980s or 90s station 8 and 9 because by the time the 80s and 90s came, I was already middle-aged, and I wasn't in the slightest way interested in that music. And I'm sure if you were 30 years younger, you might feel the same way about the 1950s channel, or even the 1960s channel. And so what happens is that rock music has this funny way of producing cohorts in the population who are nostalgic for very long ago rock music and not at all interested in its modern form.
What do you make of the reincorporation of popular music from one era into the music of another? I mean, one thinks of the sampling of hip-hop, which takes music that's very clearly time-stamped from one period and moves it into another. How do you understand that? Is that, can we understand that also through the lens of nostalgia?
Well, I mean, some of it is done that way. Really common, and this is common in a lot of popular culture, there's an attempt to reach beyond that cohort by trying to find ways of linking a contemporary form of music, be it hip hop or whatever, to past forms that an older group can recognize. One of the things that you find in old rock shows, there will be an interest on the part of young people in music that maybe their parents or grandparents even were interested in. And so this is one of the ways that you create generational ties is by trying to find ways of recreating those linkages.
Of course, as you're noting, consumed nostalgia is not just about someone's memory of the past, but often is produced. And one of the places that seems most obvious is through television and the movies and the way that any particular period is remembered. So the 1950s was re-remembered for the public in the 1970s as a time of innocence before all the tumult of the 60s and 70s. Do you think that how decades are remembered in time is historically shaped by what has come after that and the sense for a need to either remember a quieter, better time, which may or may not have existed, or to kind of erase the past, which I think has gone on in some of the nostalgia about the 60s?
Sure. Well, one of the things that happens with nostalgia is there is a kind of cleansing of the past. There is very much a selection of what is remembered from the past. And so it isn't surprising that in the early 1970s, there was a kind of a nostalgia for the 50s. You see it in things like Happy Days, for example, and you have the Fonz that is really the greaser that in the 1950s people were afraid of, and he's turned into just a kind of a eccentric, interesting fellow who talks a little bit different, and so what that does is that it helps people think about the past is, of course, better than the present, and it also helps people forget about and sort of soften some of the old antagonisms that people had about that earlier period, in this case the 1950s. If you do the 60s, it's very similar. People don't remember some of the clashes during the civil rights movement or the anti-war movement. What they remember is Love Beads and the softer side of the Haight-Ashbury experience in 1967. And you remember these, what I remember myself as being these highly superficial issues of clothes and speech and and all that, and really forget just how terribly serious those movements were when they appeared, and just how frightening they were to the elites, and more particularly just how what a big sharp contrast they were in terms of challenging the status quo. I mean, I was a part of it.
What about theme parks and their role in nostalgia, the, to some people, inexplicable appeal of these Disney theme parks that adults want to go to?
Well, the modern theme park is interesting because particularly the Disney phenomena, the Disneyland of 1955, it's radically different from the old amusement parks that really began about 50 years earlier. Those amusement parks were about novelty, and they were about breaking away from the past, particularly for immigrants in places like New York. They would go down and they would be able to get away from their ethnic neighborhoods and the like, and engage in thrill rides or spectacles or whatever. The Disney phenomena of 1955 is an attempt on the part of Disney to recreate his own childhood, basically. And he invites a generation born when he was born, which was in 1900, these would be grandparents, to try to share their childhood memories with their offspring, and then also to bring in his cartoons, Disney cartoons, so that adults who were brought up with those cartoons 20 years earlier could share them with their baby boom children. And of course, this has been very successful in this kind of combination of childhood wonder at seeing a sort of a life-size Mickey Mouse walking around, no longer in a book or in a cartoon, but kind of writ large, and also sharing that with a parent or grandparent who has these nostalgic memories of Mickey Mouse when they were growing up. And so the theme park has been really good at perpetuating this popular culture built around stories, around movies, and other things, and making it into a kind of a pilgrimage site. You don't go to Lourdes. You go to or the Grand Canyon or whatever. It's another way of thinking of it. Sites of religious, the sacred in religious terms or natural terms. You go to a site that that celebrates celebrates childhood, really, and remembrance of childhood.
Historian Gary Cross is my guest. He is the author of Consume Nostalgia, Memory in the Age of Fast Capitalism. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You suggest that consume nostalgia is not just a fake thing. So what is it, and how does it satisfy needs that we may have, and to what degree is it insufficient?
Well, it's not fake in the sense that the people who promote it, be they, people selling old-time radio shows or television shows, old-time songs or souvenirs of Disneyland, it really is, all those things are a response to people's needs to find ways of recovering a past that has more or less vanished simply because things have changed so much over the course of their lives. This what's sometimes called social acceleration has really picked up in the last 30 or 40 years to a point that people have really not much sense of continuity with even their more recent pasts. And so there's a kind of an inevitable longing to find some way to find some roots, to find some way of connecting themselves with their own deeper lives. And so it isn't surprising that people try to find these things in objects, particularly objects close to childhood, which, even though they were ephemeral, they appear in our own eyes to be kind of timeless, and more real than things that have occurred and objects that have come to us in the more recent past. Yet, when Pete, and I think this is a fairly inevitable thing. I mean, I'm of an age where I'm quite frankly interested in a lot of things about my own childhood and trying to find ways to make more sense of my life by, in a way, conversing with my younger self and my younger life. You know, I think that's actually not a bad thing to do at a certain stage. And I, find people doing it all the time. The trouble is, by focusing on these objects, be they toys or old cars or just old music, what you really are doing is a couple of things. One is you're not helping yourself understand really your own past in your own life. You've sugarcoated them. You've reduced your own childhood to some objects that you possess. Right, a lot of your own your own past is about relationships, and very often those get lost in a kind of a fetishism of objects. And then also, what happens is that you make the whole stress upon early childhood more important than it probably should be. What about reflecting on your years, much, much more closer to the present, your 40s, your 30s, or what have you? And so what I really sort of argue is that this kind of consumer nostalgia points to things that people really need and want, which is to try to make sense of their own lives by reflecting on their own past. But it doesn't really necessarily get them to a very deep understanding of that past.
Do you think that consumed nostalgia is an especially American phenomenon?
It tends to be, and it's in part because consumer capitalism is more developed here than it is in other countries, and particularly the fastness of consumer capitalism is more extensive here, although you certainly see it elsewhere. I mean, I've been to meetings where I've talked to people who've given papers about East Europeans' nostalgia for say Romania in 1980 or something of that sort. And they're not nostalgic for the regime particularly, but they're nostalgic for the car or the brand of soap or whatever. And so, again, just given the nature of modern life built around consumer goods, very often these objects take on emotional meaning that they certainly wouldn't have or couldn't possibly take in an earlier era.
This may seem like a strange question, but what are, beyond maybe the immediate personal, what are the benefits of recollection anyway? What are the stakes here? Why does this matter?
Well, in part, I mean, I'm a historian. I believe in recollection. what's important is that people don't forget things that we want to forget because we have a desire to make our lives simpler, to make them perhaps more comfortable, and there's a need for understanding the past, so that we can maybe make a midlife correction in certain ways, that we can get a better understanding of why we've made certain decisions, and not just personally, but communally as well. You know, was it really, you know, such a great idea to become so, and it's basically directed toward this idea of an economy based upon perpetual growth. You know, I mean, it's a theme. When do we get that idea? When do we decide not to emphasize our freedom from the market instead of more goods? To take a pretty basic decision. And so it's important that we kind of reflect upon our past collectively and individually to kind of revisit questions that perhaps and answers that we have made in the past that we might need to revisit and rethink about and maybe challenge.
Gary Cross has been my guest. He's professor of modern history at Pennsylvania State University, author of many books on childhood consumption, technology, work, and popular culture. We've been discussing his book, Consumed Nostalgia, Memory in the Age of Fast Capitalism, which is published by Columbia University Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.